On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer. Kent, glad you could be here. A package of bills introduced by Republicans last month aims to tighten eligibility for unemployment benefits and Medicaid coverage with an end goal of improving the state's tight labor market. Governor Evers said at a news conference Thursday in La Crosse, we have record low unemployment and the fewest number of unemployed people in our state's history. But
we know that throughout this pandemic, there are communities and families that have seen disproportionate outcomes and worries regarding health and economic well-being.
That's courtesy of WIZM FM. Have you received unemployment benefits recently? What difference did it make? Did you get health coverage through Medicaid? Would losing it make you more likely to return to the workforce? 800-642-1234. Abby Barlow-Wiley is Legislative and Compliance Director for Legal Action of Wisconsin. Abby, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. So Legal Action of Wisconsin speaking out against 7 of the 10 bills in this collection that could restrict benefits that unemployed people can receive. How does your legal aid organization decide which bills to weigh in on?
Thank you. Yes. So Legal Action has, we provide free civil legal aid to low-income people in 39 of Wisconsin's southern counties. So we see a broad range of what poverty looks like from urban and rural areas, old and young, across every ethnic and racial background. So when thinking about the impact that bills would have on our clients, we think about the experiences that our clients have that they bring to us, their struggles, their needs, and really look at legislation to try to bring their voice to the legislature.
Perhaps footsteps that a lawmaker crafting a bill might not think about or be in touch with?
That's exactly right. Unfortunately, people with low incomes often don't have much voice, don't have much touch with their members of the legislature, don't have that in their priority list of getting through the day to call up their legislator and let them know what life is like for them as they're just struggling to get by every day.
Were you surprised at all at this package of legislation? Did anything cause you pause that really struck you as a surprise?
Well, look, I mean, if the pandemic has taught us anything, it is the precariousness of our health and economic security. We know that even before the pandemic, 40% of Americans didn't have $400 in the bank for emergency expenses. And in the pandemic economy, we saw people lose their livelihoods, right? And found the rug suddenly pulled out from under them, including many people who had never experienced or expected to experience poverty before. I think what's surprising is this rush to act like we are out of the pandemic economy, when for many people, they are still living in it. Even though the average state unemployment number is good, we are still seeing people struggle. We are still seeing an intense reliance on benefits as people search for family-sustaining employment. And so to answer your question, what's surprising me is that, you know, we should be, the idea that now is the time to be making it harder for people to access benefits, it's not what people need.
Hmm. Abby Barlow-Wiley with us, Legislative and Compliance Director for Legal Action of Wisconsin. We're discussing this collection of bills that would change Wisconsin's unemployment compensation system. With your insights, 800-642-1234, have you received unemployment benefits in the pandemic? What difference did it make to your life? What was that process like? You can join in with your insights on these bills and what you want to know about them. 800-642-1234. Let's start with Medicaid, Abby. One of these bills, and I say Medicaid, but Badger Care, as we call it here, someone who turns down a job or turns down a promotion that pays more than the maximum income ceiling to qualify for Medicaid. What concern does this bill cause for you?
This is a very concerning bill for our clients. You know, employers are not privy to employees' personal lives. They might not understand that their employees are working for multiple employers. Our clients often work multiple part-time low-wage jobs. But under this bill, employers could put employees' critical health care coverage at risk by reporting them, claiming that they refused the job or hours, in order to stay on Medicaid without having to confess any credibility to that claim. But we know at Legal Action, the truth is that there are many reasons why somebody might turn down a job offer or an increase in hours. People with low incomes have caregiving responsibilities, even if they don't have children, caring for a sick parent or spouse, a grandparent caring for grandchildren in a child care emergency, mm-hmm. an uncle who watches his sister's kids so she can go to AA meetings. And maybe the job offer is 30 miles away, but your car was repossessed last week. Maybe you're a woman working at a gas station and your employer is asking you to add hours from 8 p.m. to 1 a.m. on your shift. Maybe you're dealing with depression, right? We see a lot of people struggling with mental illness, and maybe you simply just cannot handle the additional work. So for whatever reason, the job or hours might just not be right for you. And that's true for everyone, right? Anytime any of us are considering a job offer or different hours or a different schedule, there are a lot of factors that we take into consideration to determine whether that job, whether those hours are right for us and for our family.
Because something else is going to have to give.
Exactly. That's right. And what's so upsetting is that this bill would push the most vulnerable people living on low incomes, into accepting work or increased hours, regardless of whether it works for them or their families. You know, it's a lot of these bills are I think in their best light, they're saying there's fraud here. We need to address fraud. We don't see fraud. And this bill does not, it's simply not fraudulent to say no to a job or to an increase in hours. But under this bill, people could lose their critical health care coverage nonetheless.
It's interesting, too, in the written testimony that Legal Action Wisconsin put forth on this, that this wouldn't require an employer's report to be, quote, credible, and it opens the door for employers to report an employee anytime someone rejects an employee's offer. What power dynamic concerns do you see there?
Right. I mean, incredible power dynamic concerns, right? Employers already have tremendous power over employees, especially for people who work low-wage jobs. Their hours, their wages are determined by their employer. They lack flexibility. They often don't have any sick leave, any paid time off at all to deal with emergencies. And so the idea that we would be increasing that power dynamic on the side of the employer is very troubling. You know, it, you could really, when I look at this bill, what I think it's doing is punishing low-income people for being poor.
This other bill would require the state health agency to review whether people are eligible for Medicaid every 6 months instead of right. every 12 months, which DHS currently does. Why would checking eligibility every 6 months lead to more churn and into more coverage disruptions?
There are several reasons. For one, it is not easy to apply for benefits. And when you are a person on low and living on low incomes and you have variable wages and hours, people move a lot, right? They're either seeking safer housing, they are facing eviction or foreclosure. There are a lot of reasons why people with low incomes who are able to work tend to move around a lot. You know, simply one example of how this bill could affect someone is that you might not receive a notice that your eligibility is up for redetermination and not find out that you have lost your critical healthcare coverage until you're at the hospital seeking mm-hmm. care, only because you moved during the year, right? 1 year is what the wages and salaries are based on. It's what our clients are expecting. It simply creates more burden for people who are trying to get these benefits so that they can live. And it creates more administrative burden. So one reason why somebody might lose their coverage or see a gap in coverage is simply because the administrative burden on the agencies processing these applications is overwhelming. I mean, this bill more than doubles the work of agencies right now processing applications without sending any additional resources to help manage the increased workload.
Legal Action of Wisconsin attorney Abby Barlow-Wiley focuses on legal representation justice for low-income people. Are you an employer? Have you been able to hire enough workers? Do you think restricting public benefits would increase your labor pool? Has your family relied on food share? Has it helped fill gaps? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute for more State Cap with Abby Barlow-Wiley here on the Ideas Network. You are with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Republican lawmakers advancing a package of bills would add new requirements for jobless workers to maintain unemployment assistance and put a new limit on eligibility for Medicaid coverage, as we've been talking about. Join in your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Legal Action of Wisconsin legislative director and attorney Abby Barlow-Wiley is with us for about five more minutes. Let's bring in Becky now in Houstisford. Hi, Becky. What's on your mind?
Oh, hello. And I want to say thank you for Ms. Barlow-Wiley for bringing this important subject to the fore. Adding to what she said, which is so pertinent, as the bill is written, there are no guarantee that the hours offered will be permanent for the employees. So even if they'd want to take them, if taking them, then they'd suddenly be taken away. They would be without the hours and without the benefits they had been previously receiving that enabled them to survive. There's no guarantee that the employers will pay overtime for the additional hours, even though they might be nights or weekends. And there's no guarantee that in taking those hours, even the most eager employee, if in taking those hours they then lose child care and lose health care, they're going backwards. And it costs them more. It costs our society more if they get so sick they have to go to the emergency room.
Becky, thank you for bringing this up. And Abby, Becky making a number of other points here, including some backslide that could be possible.
Absolutely. You raised great points, Becky. You know, we know that people who experience disruptions in their healthcare coverage are more likely to delay care, receive less preventative care, refill prescriptions less often, and have more emergency department visits. As a result, we know it's harder for them to get work, more likely for them to lose their jobs. Research has shown time and again that being in poor health is associated with increased risk of job loss or unemployment, while access to affordable healthcare helps people to maintain their health and promotes their ability to obtain and maintain employment. So the idea that we would be trying to find creative ways to kick people off of their healthcare coverage isn't only going to hurt people like our clients and make their lives even harder. It's also going to be bad for the state and for the economy.
Well, let's turn this for a moment. Lawmakers here promoting these measures, saying they're trying to get more people into the workforce. Abby, what would help more people find jobs and land jobs that are life-sustaining?
Yeah, you know, these bills, they don't actually help people find jobs, right? These bills take a stick approach, hoping that people will feel threatened enough by the changes to magically find the family sustaining jobs that they haven't been able to secure. So what would actually help our clients would be to address the actual barriers to employment that we see our clients run up against every day. So access to reliable transportation is a big one. A job might be 30 minutes away by car or 2 hours away by bus, and our clients may not have working or reliable cars and can't afford an extra 4 hours of childcare or the cost of ride sharing on their already low wages. Or, you know, in Wisconsin, people can get their driver's licenses suspended because of their inability to pay fees, right? Basically, you can get your driver's license suspended because you're in poverty. And then your choices are, do I risk getting pulled over and facing increased fees and increased tickets on my way to work, or do I not get to work? So increasing access to transportation would be big. Increasing access to childcare for birth to three and beyond, to family care. You know, a lot of people provide care to their elderly, disabled family members but receive very little, if any, compensation. Addressing the affordable housing crisis, when, you know, housing instability is a major issue for our clients that takes up a lot of their days seeking safe, stable housing for themselves and their families. And in fact, about 50%, a little bit under 50% of our clients are people with children in the home. And, you know, if we were to expand Medicaid, right, we are one of 12 states to not have done so. I know the governor has proposed this, but the legislature has so far refused.
So what you're saying is you have to address the root causes of poverty before you decide to pull back on unemployment benefits.
Exactly right. That's exactly right. You know, unemployment benefits are often the sole reason why our clients are able to pay rent, keep the heat and hot water going in the winter, afford shoes and socks and clothes for their children. You know, these are critical benefits that provide a lifeline, a literal economic lifeline to people in the darkest times of their lives. And so to fathom taking it away and to imagine that that would somehow help people find jobs, it's fiction.
Abby, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Abby Barlow-Wiley, Legislative and Compliance Director for Legal Action of Wisconsin. Now, political polarization of the pandemic hasn't spared Wisconsin school boards. Mask disputes, unruly crowds, shutdown meetings, board members faced recalls, and some have resigned over threats. That's led to charged local primaries on tomorrow's ballots. Madeline Fox has more.
Kathy Olig's first campaign to be a Menominee Falls school board member in 2019 feels simple now.
I purchased some yard signs. I talked to people about voting. I participated in the candidate forum. There was just one. And everything kind of went fairly smoothly.
But this year, there are 8 candidates for 3 open slots in Menominee Falls. So she's competing in our first primary.
I think that the schools have been put under scrutiny as a result of what's happening nationally.
That's true in a lot of communities, especially in the suburbs.
You know, as a former school board member, I ran 4 times. 2 I ran without any competition, and 2 I ran with a lot of competition. I think it ebbs and flows.
Terry Phillips is the executive director of the Southeast Wisconsin Schools Alliance. She says that while school board positions are nonpartisan, politics are playing a bigger role.
There are board members who are conservative Republicans who are being contested because they're not conservative enough, apparently. And so that's been so interesting to watch.
Part of that may have to do with national conservative groups looking to regain ground in increasingly competitive suburbs. Vladimir Kogan is a political science professor who studies state and local politics at Ohio State University.
Part of this is, I think, you know, a really rational and strategic effort by, I would say, primarily Republicans who see this opportunity, and probably rightly, right, that this, I do think this is a great opportunity for Republicans to win back suburbs that historically have been pretty red, but now are more and more blue.
Many primary candidates got involved over concerns about how their district was handling COVID-19. But they're getting a boost from national parties and political action committees, which can provide money, strategy, and help gathering signatures and getting the word out. Those were at play in the unusually large wave of recalls over the last 2 years. 17 districts saw recall attempts, including one against Butternut School Board member Gary Murdig in northern Wisconsin, who defeated a December challenge.
It kind of split the community a little bit, which is unfortunate because there are the pro-mask and anti-mask folks.
Murdig isn't up for election until next year, but Butternut will have school board primaries this year for other seats, which has been a rarity during his 31 years on the board.
I'm trying to think the last time we would have had a primary for school board is it's been a long time.
Murdig and others watching rural schools say board meetings are drawing fewer angry community members these days. But some wonder if debates over critical race theory will bring them back. Vladimir Kogan, the Ohio State political scientist, said school board clashes over national hot-button issues aren't new. Sex education, the Common Core, evolution, and voucher programs all cause similar uproar.
You know, there's always national conversations about education. But those are, in the past, were counterbalanced by local conversations about local issues. And I think that counterbalancing is going away.
There are fewer local newspapers to send reporters to school board meetings, so many communities don't know enough about local issues to take the focus off national debates. But Murdig says most school board business is local or deals with thorny regulatory questions, which can be frustrating for politicized candidates that win elections.
Once in a while, we'll have an issue that would have come up over the years, and sometimes it spurs interest in certain people running for the board, and they become a one-issue candidate. And then as soon as they get on the board, they kind of lose interest.
After the primaries narrow the field in some districts, all the school board races will go to general election on April 5th. Madeline Fox, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And just ahead, the State Capitol Report continues with Republican State Representative Jeremy Thiensfeld. We'll talk schools. What action do you want lawmakers to take on K-12 education? 800-642-1234. News update is next on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Assembly Republicans, they introduced a package of bills that would make sweeping changes to K-12 education and perhaps most notably break apart Milwaukee Public Schools into a bunch of smaller districts. That's part of the package that would expand the number of charter schools and offer private school vouchers to all students, regardless of family income. Should Milwaukee's school district be broken up? What should DPI do to turn around declining test scores and close the achievement gap between black and white students? 800-642-1234. Republican Representative Jeremy Thiensfeld of Fond du Lac chairs the Assembly's Education Committee. He's a former teacher. Representative Thiensfeld, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Good morning. Well, before we get to the classroom, you announced recently that you won't seek re-election this year. Why step aside now?
I've been in the legislature for 12 years. Mm-hmm. This is year number 12. And I'm 55 years old. And when I entered the legislature, you always get the questions about why you want to be a legislator and how long you plan on staying. And I have said consistently from the beginning that I was going to go back to teaching. And an opportunity has arisen, actually at the school that I previously taught at before I was in the legislature. And it was an opportunity I couldn't pass up. And I am actually, I'm back serving them on a part-time basis right now. We actually have off of school today.
Well,
so I get to be today.
That's interesting, too, because you were a teacher. You also did some coaching. You did some work as a principal as well, if I recall.
Yeah, I did spend 1 year as a principal of an elementary school. My congregation has a K-8 school, mm-hmm. and they got stuck in the summer without a principal and asked me if I would fill in for a year. So I was able to have that wonderful experience as well. But the school I'm going back to is a high school, and I'll be in the administration as guidance counselor and doing the scheduling, I guess the registrar is what you might call that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be doing some teaching as well starting next school year.
Well, with that in mind, let's look at this package of bills. First of all, dismantling the Milwaukee Public School District. This has come up before, and there is a lot of tension around this. Why do you support breaking up the district?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that Milwaukee Public Schools has been in crisis for quite some time. When you have the most heavily funded school district in the state, and it's the largest school district in the state, and they keep producing scores that are subpar and are amongst some of the worst in the country. We have schools in Milwaukee Public School District that have almost no students who are proficient in reading. That is a crisis. And there have been numerous attempts to change things over the years, but they have been unsuccessful. But one thing that has not been tried is breaking them up into smaller districts with the hope that smaller can be better, giving parents more of an opportunity to have better representation by a school board. Because right now the Milwaukee Public School Board, they are in charge of all of the schools, all of the public schools in Milwaukee. And by breaking it up into smaller groups of districts, you are going to be able to have more representation, different representation for families across Milwaukee. And you also have the opportunity for, you have more opportunity for more opportunities for students. So I think it is really important that we take a serious look at this. I have my doubts that the bill is going to become law, because I'm pretty certain Tony Evers is going to veto it. But it's a discussion we should start having. Even though I'm not going to be here next session, I think it's an important thing, discussion to continue next session.
And I appreciate that. Digging in a little bit more here, how do you see a breakup as a solution to the poverty issues going on, the equity issues, the overall need of resources to live and to learn? How would a breakup into smaller districts be a solution to those real basic needs in the community?
Well, I would answer that in two ways. Number one, I do not believe that poverty necessarily means that you are going to be a poor student. I just don't accept that notion whatsoever. Just because you are a poverty-stricken family, perhaps, doesn't mean that you are not as good of a parent and care less about your children. And so we need to give these parents a different way of doing things, because what's going on is not working. You know, we're obviously not going to be able to change the economic makeup of Milwaukee just by splitting up the school districts. But what we're doing now is simply not working. And by getting some people together from a wide variety of backgrounds who have experienced changes in schools, perhaps in different parts of the country, seeking expertise from those types of people, we're going to be able to come up with a plan. And I'll remind everybody that the plan's not coming from the legislature. Okay, the legislature is just directing the breakup, and then the plan would be coming from a group of people who would put the plan together, experts and so forth, and then they would look to implement it. And so I'm not going to continue to allow MPS to just simply reorganize the deck chairs on the Titanic and continue doing the same thing that they've been doing essentially for years. There must be change, and this is an idea that has some possibilities of success, and we owe it to the parents to give it a try.
Talking with Representative Jeremy Thiesfeldt from Fond du Lac, Chair of the Assembly's Committee on Education, as we look at a package of bills affecting K-12. You can join in, 800-642-1234. So along the lines of you saying we need to do things differently and give more power back to the parents, this parental bill of rights, this would allow parents essentially also to sue government bodies for interfering with their child's education, with their child's health care, or their upbringing, mental health. Why do you think this bill is necessary?
Well, any time you have a situation where schools are essentially ignoring basic rights of parents, we have schools that are deciding that students have to, let me start that again. We have schools where students are able to identify their own gender, and then the schools are keeping it secret from the parents. You know, if there's anything that would be a basic right of a parent, it's when sensitive issues like that come forward and they do not make the effort to inform the parents who own this child, essentially, and are keeping that basic information from them.
Well, aren't you concerned about outing children? But aren't you concerned about outing children who come out as gay or transgender at school before coming out in their own homes?
I believe that my biggest concern is that children belong to their parents, and parents are the ones who have their children's best interests in mind. Schools are not parents. Parents don't need to be co-parenting with the government, which is essentially what public schools are. They're government schools. And that is an abomination to me that a school would make sensitive decisions like that without consulting with parents.
There's also a property tax credit in this bill. What is that about?
That is my bill, actually. The property tax credit bill is aimed as an encouragement to schools who made the decision to go virtual for more than 10 days in the second half of the current school year. So from January 1st, essentially, to when school year closes in May or June. If they made the decision to do that 10 or more days, the property taxpayers of that particular district would receive essentially a rebate on their property taxes. And this is being done because schools, it has been shown, it is not necessary for them to go virtual. There are mitigation efforts that can be made. And there needs to be a really, really good reason for them to go virtual when we know the damage in particular that this has been doing to students across the state and across the nation. And so this is an encouragement for them to not take that measure, but instead use the massive amounts of federal funding that were given to the schools to make mitigation efforts so that they can keep those students in school.
Let's bring on a caller now. Rosa is joining us from Waterford. Hi, Rosa. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. So my sister received a job offer in one of the northern areas of Milwaukee in the library, and she was told by the principal she was hired. She waited 3 weeks for, he says, a letter from or package from HR would be forthcoming, and she waited three some weeks. She received a letter saying, thank you for interviewing, but you did not get the offer, and she was just shocked. So she quickly scrambled around, found another job in a few days. Then she called the principal of that high school, and he said, oh, that was a mistake. And then he said, I always have problems with HR. So the bottom line, I agree with you. It needs to be broken up. Even HR can't handle the massive amount of employees they have to deal with. They're making mistakes.
Rosa, thank you for bringing that to the forefront here. Representative Thiensfeld, do you feel like smaller districts would be able to handle more HR responsibilities in a more streamlined way?
Well, I think bigger is not always better. We get caught up in that sort of thing. And I've served in small schools because I've served in private schools in my teaching experience. I think the biggest school that I served in is the one that I'm currently at. It's a high school. It's got just over 300 students. When I taught elementary, the biggest school I was in was about 150 students. That was K through 8. The smaller the situation, I believe the more responsive you are to the families that are involved. You're much more than just a number to the faculty and the administration when your numbers are smaller. And so I think that is one of the key possibilities is that it gets to be much more of, you might say, a family-friendly environment. And when you have these massive bureaucracies, which I would describe MPS as being that, you become more distant from the customers, which are the parents.
We're discussing a package of Republican-authored bills that would expand vouchers, break apart Milwaukee public schools, as we've been talking about, create a parent's bill of rights, making, among other items in the package, with Republican Representative Jeremy Thiensfeld of Fond du Lac, chairs the Assembly's Committee on Education. You can join in. Have you debated whether to enroll your child in a charter school? How did you arrive at that decision? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're discussing a slate of Republican-backed K-12 education bills. The state's top education official, State Superintendent Jill Underle, said in a statement Thursday in response to the Assembly's Education Committee hearing, quote, "The legislature is proposing bills that will do nothing to help our public schools. They're proposing bills that are intended to divide us, to pit parents against teachers." How do you feel about these bills? What stands out to you that is helpful or harmful to your child's educational future? Still time, 800-642-1234. Representative Jeremy Thiesfeld, chair of the Education Committee, with us for about 9 more minutes. We heard from Amy in Galesville, called in, couldn't stay with us, and Amy said that the parents don't own their kids, and Amy is concerned the Parents' Bill of Rights does not have enough in it for the child's input. How do you feel about that? What would you say to Amy?
Well, I want to make sure I heard you say that the parents don't own their kids. Did I hear that correctly? If that was the case, I guess I don't understand that. I mean, I'm not looking at this in terms of like ownership, or do you want to buy something? But children belong to their parents. And so right off the bat, if that's what she says, I think that we're going to have a strong disagreement there. Children are children, and they are in need of parenting. And whether a school thinks that they know better than what a parent does, that is not an option. You know, the parents are the ones who are responsible for their children's education. The school is there to assist the parents in the education of that child. So if that's what you really said, I think we're going to have a strong disagreement right off the bat.
Well, when I read the Parental Bill of Rights, I feel like this bill is almost exactly what Florida's lawmakers passed and their governor signed into law last year. Did you look to Florida to model this legislation?
Don't recall exactly who the author of the bill is. I was not involved in putting the bill together, but it's not unsurprising that legislators look to other states, just as other states, I'm sure, look at things Wisconsin is doing. Mm-hmm. The reason you need to reinvent the wheel on all this stuff is something is a good idea in one state, why not give it a try in another state? And as far as those Bill of Rights, I would challenge anybody to read over the list of the 15 points and tell me one thing that is in there that they disagree with.
Let's go to Dan now in Appleton. Hi, Dan.
Hello. I had a thought that occurred to me when you were discussing the property tax credit for people who are impacted by the schools. And I was wondering if there's any maybe more effective means of targeting that population, given that a portion of the people who were impacted may be renters and may not actually see the benefit of a tax credit, specifically those, you know, maybe in urban environments.
Dan, thank you for that. Representative Thiesfeld.
I would have to review the bill once again. We had the hearing on it last week, but if my memory serves me correctly, I believe that there is something in there regarding a property tax credit for renters. And if that is not the case, that certainly is something that I would consider.
Dan, thank you. Chris now in Milwaukee. Chris, go ahead.
Hi. I think it's fine if you want to not give schools money because they weren't open, but I want to claw back the money from a do-nothing legislature that was known for not being open. You guys did less than any other legislature, I think, in history, and I want my money back for that, too.
So, Chris, concerned that the legislature not acting, especially in the early times of the pandemic, Representative Thiesfeld?
Well, I am not certain how that would come about. As far as I would assume, she's talking about during 2020. And during that period of time, the legislature was out of session. And we, in fact, did come back into session. I believe it was in March or April, and we did pass a slate of bills. So what I believe she's indicating is not accurate.
I want to land here on school vouchers. 19 schools joining Wisconsin's program that allows families below a certain income threshold to use vouchers to attend private schools. Your colleagues have supported extending vouchers to all families regardless of income level. Why take this step in the program?
Because parents should be able to decide where their children are educated, what best suits their needs. And the government's interest in this is that children are educated. I don't understand why the government would be confused or, why a government would object to a family deciding that they would like to have an education at a private school if the private school is willing to have them.
Well, I think the fear here is that you expand the number of charter schools, and that means that essentially you defund public schools where 90% of students are enrolled. And should Wisconsin be concerned about that expansion? That's the heart of it.
No, I don't see there's a concern there. If the public schools believe that they are doing a better job of educating their students, then they have nothing to be concerned about. Parents will want to go there. The competition aspect of school is an important aspect of it. Schools are collaborative, but they're also competitive. And if we have, I would say one of my proudest accomplishments in my time in the legislature has been the expansion of options and making sure that the public is aware of those options. It is good to give people opportunity to try different things. And my colleagues and I have been very successful in setting that possibility up for parents across the state in my time in the legislature.
So if you increase the number of charter schools, do you need to build up a more robust system to regulate them? What about accountability and scrutiny?
Well, are you speaking specifically of charter schools, or are you speaking of trade schools in terms of accountability?
Expanding charter schools.
Mm-hmm. Charter schools are public schools. They have numerous accountability measures. But the other point with charter schools, too, is that charter schools, the intention of them is to do things differently. And if you're going to do things differently, you certainly have to have certain types of regulation. But if you're going to do things differently, you have to be given some freedom to try some things. And so there's certainly is a measure of freedom that's involved in that other schools don't have. And I just think in general, there's too much regulation in schools.
And so that goes back to the Parental Bill of Rights. I think you're saying there that you really want parents to be in the driver's seat here and to reduce the power that school districts have.
There is no more important component to a successful school than parent engagement. I think that if you were to somehow quantify the amount of parent engagement that a school has and would go from school to school and measure that, you would find that the best schools have the most parental engagement. So we ought to be encouraging this, not pushing it aside and kind of indicating to parents that what they want doesn't matter.
Representative Thiesfeld, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. I appreciate the opportunity.
Republican Representative Jeremy Thiesfeld of Fond du Lac chairs the Assembly's Committee on Education. He was first elected to the Assembly in 2010. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is a State Capitol Report on The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.